Vale. Vale, tranquilo,
Thank you very much. Yes. Can I share my screen?
Please, go ahead. You should.
Okay. Let me...
Perfect.
Okay, do you see my screen now?
Everything perfect. Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for the possibility of discussing this recent work I've been carrying out with my collaborator, Enrico Corsaro. Actually, it was something which took a couple of years before we decided to write up what we had. It was really long history. And let me show you what is the basic motivation of the discussion. We try to understand if it's possible to have a unified view about the distribution of activity cycles in main sequence cool stars. This is, of course, a very interesting and important topic because there is a long tradition of investigation in this direction. I would like to mention early pioneering work by Wilson himself, Noyes and Banyunas, Eli Banyunas in 1996, where they basically try to ask the following question: is there a relation between the frequency of the cycle and the rotation rate of the star? And the answer from this work by Noyes and Balunas was basically based looking at Mount Wilson data, is that there is a most probably a linear relation between these two terms. Then the more recent works have changed this basic picture because Saar and Brandenburg, and before it was papered by Brandenburg and Saar, and then Saar 2002, have pointed out that probably there are multiple populations in the space of in this plane, which is what you see on the right in this figure, the rotation rate and the cycle frequency, the cycle periods. This work by Bon Vitense was quite a prominent one. As you can see, she was able to find two different trends by looking at the data, and the really interesting result of this work was that the sun apparently lies in a transition, as some people say, between these two scaling laws. But thanks to the recent exquisite photometry from Gaia and high resolution spectroscopy, we can now access a much better, more robust data set. And the question is whether this picture is still something we can rely on. We have to change something. And most important for me was the question, what is the prediction of a simple mean field dynamo theory? And after I try I try to get inside to this problem, I realize that there is a confusion in the literature. And the confusion, I think, it starts from the early papers on dynamo theory. And therefore, I decided that it's important to give you a crash course in mean field dynamo theory, although most of you knows that there are I think that there are important points that need to be stressed in this discussion. So let's imagine we consider the simplest setup possible to discuss a dynamo theory. So just a Cartesian coordinate flow of the type that you have that some velocity along the y direction dependent on z and the magnetic field with the plane geometry, as you can see. The induction equation, it's very easily written down in equation 7 and can be solved assuming a dispersion relation of a linear one. And we have basically equation 8 that we had to satisfy. In equation 8, eta is the turbulent diffusivity, k is the spatial space wave number, alpha is the alpha effect, and q is the differential rotation. Actually, it's the du over dz, so it has a dimension of 1 over time. So we have to satisfy this equation, equation 8. And there are, of course, various ways of doing so. Let's first look at the two limiting cases of large differential rotation and small differential rotation. In the case of, in the case of q equals 0, means no differential rotation, the critical solutions are given by this expression. And basically we have that the frequency of the cycle is exactly 0, and the alpha effect, the wave number is basically related with the alpha effect to the alpha effect from with equation 8. This is, of course, something that everybody knows. In this case, for a pure alpha square dynamo, we only have stationary solutions. If we instead look at large differential rotation, we can neglect the alpha square term and solve for omega, and we have this dispersion relation for the frequency of the cycle, which is nothing more than the very famous celebrated Parker 55 solution. So what happens here? That at very large times, we have that omega is given by this simple expression. And now if we approximate the alpha effect with omega times L, where L is the characteristic length of the turbulence, and Q is basically proportional to omega, we immediately get equation 13. Though the first point that of the discussion is the following. If we are in the unstable phase, according to the famous work by Parker, the frequency of the cycle must be proportional to the rotation rate. But the important point that people often forget is the following. This dynamo is not critical. That means that there is no basically back reaction of the Lorentz force into the field, into the flow equation, and we don't know what happens eventually after the linear phase. Okay, so this is a non-critical solution. If we instead solve the dispersion relation for the critical case without doing any assumption on the differential rotation on alpha, we get these two solutions here. The alpha is the critical alpha, and omega is given by equation 14. And for large Q, we end up with a very different situation. Omega is now constant. So it is something which I found really almost nowhere in the literature, except in papers from the people who do simulations. but no way in the discussion of observational paper the possibility that omega is constant, and this constant is just a reflection that we are in a pure alpha omega state in a critical situation, okay? And this constant can be estimated by simple mixed length theory, and it turns out that this constant is fixed by duration of the rotation period over the turnover convective time. In general, this omega, the frequency of the cycle here as a function of the differential rotation, has this plot, this type of dependence. So it saturates a very large Q, but meanwhile can have all possible, let's say, values between zero and the saturation value. While alpha, it tends to zero at very large Q, a very large differential rotation, but this is of course expected because as in the case of very strong differential rotation, the alpha effect to get the dynamo induced is expected to be very, very small. So to summarize what we have, we can say that for a fast rotator in the critical regime, the frequency of the cycle is given by this expression. In the case of small rotation, the critical regime is given by equation 18. And for a fast rotation in the non-critical case, we have equation 19. So omega is proportional to the differential rotation. It's only in this case that we have this simple law. So in other words, what mean field theory predicts is the following, that if we are near the criticality or near criticality, the frequency of the cycle must be decided by a scaling law of this type with nu greater than zero, smaller than one. In the unstable phase, the frequency of the cycle is proportional to omega. Observations. Historically, the search for correlations between P cycle and P rot has been decided on the basis of the active versus non-active dichotomy. What is that? Is basically an offset of the scaling law in the log omega cycle over omega log R prime HK plane, which is a chromospheric activity index. And this is basically called RCRA diagrams. And it turns out, unfortunately, this approach has led to conflicting results when the classification of active versus non-active branch is used to search for correlations in the P-cycle P-rot diagram. One example is this paper, recent paper by Borosaikia et al. In 2018. They analyzed Mont Wilson and ARPS data. And it's a catalog of 40,054 cool stars with chromospheric activity, mainly KG stars and main sequence. And as you can see, a well-defined cycle lies in the inactive branch and exhibits a linear relation with the rotation, while the active branch is much more scattered in the P-rot P-cycle diagram. It is interesting that the authors conclude that when all classification of stars are considered, non-linear relationship is detected between cycle periods and rotation. So how to say, we have to impose, if we, let's say, a distinction between active versus non-active before we are able to find any branch, any population in this system. And then there was basically at the same time this important paper by Osbert and his collaborators, where they made a cluster analysis on this in this plane log P rot P cycle over log R prime HK, and they clearly find that there are the distribution is bimodal in this plane. But unfortunately, you see, when you go from the left to the right, it's difficult to find the trends scaling in this in the log P cycle, log P rot pilot plane. And the reason is the following. If you look at the plot in the left, if there is a correlation between pilot and P-cycle, it is difficult to properly make an interpretation of the plot on the left-hand side, because actually on the y-axis, you will get a constant. Imagine that pilot is proportional to P-cycle. What will happen then? And so we decided to follow a completely different path. We first constructed a new catalog where basically we merged the Osbert and Borosaikia catalog so that we end up with a much larger statistical sample. And what the way we did that is the following. We used a weighted mean between the period from Borosaikia and the quasi-periodic solution from Osbert for common targets. We excluded targets that were too different, with was period were really two different one from each other to be as most conservative as possible. And we removed one target because the period was really too chaotic. And we did a really careful cycle error determination in order to have, let's say, a final catalog composed by a sample of 67 stars. And I think this is today the largest catalog that we have on P-cycle against Pirot. And so the way we addressed the problem was we decided had to be totally different. We decided not to rely in any distinction on active versus non-active branch, but we thought it was much better to work directly in this OC or R plane, which is log omega C log omega plane. And we ask ourselves the following. Let's consider a distribution of points in this plane. And let's imagine we have lines, we draw lines in this plane. Can we associate probability to a distribution of lines and look what happens if we have only one line to feed the data or two lines, three lines to feed the data instead? This is a completely different approach because what we look is to the possibility of having multiple scanning law, and the correct way, the best way of doing that is doing a Bayesian analysis and the model comparison between different model and different scaling law. And so we basically decided to compare a model where we had two different, completely random type of scaling, like model one. And then we had model two with only one linear regression was possible. And then we had to construct a likelihood for this case. So this was really something really non-trivial because how to construct a likelihood for a population for a multiple population. In principle, you have to compute an expression of this type where A is given by this Gaussian type of function, and BE is given by the other type of Gaussian function. But you see, you have a sine square psi, cosine square psi, where psi basically goes from 0 to pi over 2. And depending on the value of psi, you are either in one population or in two populations. So in principle, this is a very, very general setting where you can ask the question, what is the posterior probability that your data are really described with the multiple population? And you can see here, you have basically five free parameters. nu1, nu2, b1, b2, and psi, and for and to address this to compute this likelihood properly, we use a nested sampling Monte Carlo code developed by Enrico Corsaro and the Riden, which is called Diamonds. And that was not enough, because you do have to be very careful about huge numerical overflow. So we had to use tricks like the expression in the logarithmic logarithm identity below to be sure we our numbers were correct. Okay, then we went to, we were at this point able to do a model comparison. So to really look for the ratio of the evidence, which is basically the Bayes factor in one case and the other case, we basically use the same priors for all the models. And the result is the following: model M1 with two scaling law as log B1 2, which is much evidence, much larger than the other case. So that is really the ratio of the evidence B1 over 2. And therefore, we can conclude in a using a very robust statistical approach that two populations are really favored. And not only that, these two populations are described by two different scaling law, one with positive scaling law and the other with negative. So at this point, I would like to stop. Maybe there are questions on this part of the talk. I'll be happy to take those.
I don't see any questions right now. Okay. Also, yeah, that's the one by Matthias now. Matthias, please.
Hello. Hello, Alfio. Thank you very much.
Hello, Matthias.
So about your mean fields analysis at the beginning, to get to the critical state, of course, you have assumed that the back reaction doesn't change the fundamental properties of the mean field model, like isotropy and so on. So that you have assumed that the magnetic field acts back in essentially reducing alpha and probably also eta, and that makes it possible to perform further. But of course, this is a very, very restrictive assumption, because we have different channel of back reaction and isotropy cannot be preserved in the moment there is a mean field which is dynamically relevant. I understand that without a very good mathematical model of the back reaction, it's hardly possible to proceed in any way analytically here. But you're somehow are relying upon your these final results about the dependency of omega cycle on omega or Q. And this is not really a robust result. Well, would you agree?
No, I don't. My experience is that if I use a simple linear critical solution, and if I try to use the alpha quenching to get all saturation, these two numbers agree very well. So no matter what you use for quenching, even if it's, non-local quenching or not, if you just solve the eigenvalue solution and you ask for critical solution, for just having no growing solution or no increasing solution, that gives precisely what you will get using a more complicated quenching function. So I will think that even this simple, linear mean field model should be able to capture the physics not so wrong way. Let me say this way. It cannot be totally wrong.
Yeah, totally wrong is maybe really too strong a term. But at least you rely upon the isotropy of alpha and eta. And that's not fully true in the
moment. Matthias, I will come back to your, I will come back to answer your question at the end of the talk more properly. Mm-hmm. So I'll be happy to take your question after, at the end.
Okay, yeah. So I was mistaken. I thought the talk was already at the end.
No, that was my idea is, let's try to understand, if it's possible to understand the data as they are, with the simple, the simplest Dynamo model we are had. And point is that already with a very simple, say childish model, it's possible to make progress up to some point, and you will see where what I mean.
Okay. Yeah, then go on and we come to that back later. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. So the results are presented in this plot. You can see what happens if we classify, if we use our Bayesian model. You have basically clearly evident two different scaling laws. And it is clear that we have one population for which the cycle, the frequency of the cycle increases with the rotation rate, and another population for which the frequency of the cycle decreases with the rotation rate. Okay, so we call the first group G1 and the second group G2. And you can see already from this plot that there is not a strong difference between group one and group two in terms of chromospheric index. So we ask, what is the reason? What makes this difference? And so what we did is to use basically Gaia DR3 data, low resolution spectra and high resolution spectra, in order to have to cross correlate fundamental stellar property like metallicity, age, and chromospheric activity index within the G1 and G2 group. Basically, we took stellar ages from Gaia DR3, from Bastia isochrons, and Star Ors, which is another co-developed IIP in Potsdam, where when some point in the Gaia DR3 APIS catalog was missing, with the total 45 stars, where we could get ages precisely according to the isochrons. That is our final distribution of the catalog. So you can see that that's public. We have low resolution, high resolution, final metallicity age, and all these other properties, also the convective turnover time. So the first interesting thing is the following. We find that stars in G2 are 40% more metal rich than stars in G1, with median metallicity values for G1 minus 0.9 dex and for G2 0.05 dex. We perform a Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, and the two distribution appear different to a p-value level of 0.015. So this is very close to the usual limit adopted for a strong detection. You should know that the number of stars is reduced because we had to merge low resolution spectra with high resolution spectra in order to get a statistically robust in terms of measurements number of stars. In other words, the problem is that if you insist too much in low resolution spectra, there is a, it's a, you might be, there is a risk that you might encounter difficulties because those are very bright stars. And so Gaia might have problems in that. So to basically address this issue, we really wanted to be sure that our result was correct, and we find that low resolution spectra are actually very well correlated with high resolution spectra by Valentin, Fisher, and Luck, very recent measurements of this type of stars, and we were able to merge the Gaia spectra and high resolution spectra. That's why we were at the end we end up with a smaller set, but very precise set of stars for which we could perform this Kolmogorov test. And therefore, you can see here the same diagram that we've seen before, that already by Heis, the G1 population is less metallic than G2, the white points is where we could not find the metallicity measurements, okay? And now we turn to the age, and the result is also interesting because it is in agreement to what we have found with the metallicity. We basically found that stars in G2 are about 25% older than those in G1. The median value is about 2.8 gigayears for G1 stars and 3.5 gigayears for G2 stars. Note that the sun is in G2. So although the P value is 0.17, it's interesting that the trend is in agreement with our finding for the metallicity, because of course if we consider star with lower metallicity, the opacity is reduced, and therefore they have a faster evolution, and they are therefore they will be younger. And that is what you find in the case of the distribution of age in this context. And then we decided to make a comparison with the gyrochronology, and basically we used the recipe by Barnes 2007. And we noted that while ages from gyrochronology are basically in agreement with those from isochrons for G1, but where we obtain a median gyro age of 2.6 gigayears, it's interesting there is a huge discrepancy for stars in G2, because the gyro ages are much, much younger, much according to gyrochronology. And then if you think to these results, what is the only possibility, I mean, at least a possibility to explain the difference between these two numbers, is that in the case of G2, what should happen is that they should rotate much slower than observer to match the isochron age. So our prediction will be that G2 must have a stronger wind than usually is thought, that will probably make for a different gyrochronology calibration in this case. And now, of course, this is a very delicate point, because if this is true, that means that the sun, which is used as a reference point for the calibration of gyrochronology, could not be a good reference point. So how about activity index? In the case of activity index, the result is the following. Basically, there is no real difference between the two populations. The Kolmogorov-Smirnov test is about p-value is greater than 0.9, so the two distributions are essentially not distinguishable. So there is no relation between, let's say, the active and non-active branch that has been found studying this distribution of chromospheric index and these two trends, these two scaling law that we found in this other plane. Then we also look at mass, log G, and luminosity. And in agreement with the finding that we had for the metallicity, the luminosity of group one is higher than the luminosity of group two, as is expected. So it really seems everything really points towards the conclusion that metallicity is the key role, element in deciding whether one star has a dynamo for which the frequency of the cycle increases with the rotation or vice versa, decrease. And then, is it possible to have an interpretation of the positive slope? And that's to answer the question by Matthias. The plot that you see here is the calculation of this new index here, exactly from this very simple critical model that you have seen. And this is new as a function of the ratio of the turbulent characteristic, a turbulent length scale, and the radius of the star for a turbulent diffusivity of 10 to the 14 centimeters square second. This is, let's say, it's, I would say, it's reassuring that we are on the right path. And of course, it's not a proof of anything, but it's really amazing that one get this new with the right order of magnitude from such a simple model with numbers which resembles numbers that one can expect in reality. Here the radius is slightly bigger than the radius of the sun, but that doesn't matter, and the rotation rate is 25 days. More complicated is the interpretation of the negative slope. Now, let's assume angular momentum conservation along the azimuthal direction. That implies that in the bulk of the convection zone, we can write the convective velocity square as proportional, basically, to meridional circulation times omega times r. But we know that in the case of advection-dominated dynamo, the frequency of the cycle is proportional to the meridional circulation with some scaling exponent, which is 0.79. So if you just forget about the fact that this number this delta is different from what we got from simulation, it is interesting to see that you get a negative slope. So the lesson here is that the sun belongs to the G2 group, and if we imagine that other stars have similar meridional circulation excited, then we would expect that the frequency of the cycle has to decrease with the rotation rate. So I can come to the conclusion now. I think that from our results, we can say the stars can be classified into groups according to whether the period of activity increases, the frequency of the activity, not the period, increases or decreases with the rotation. In both cases, a simple scaling law, and that is something which I think is something which is strongly in favor to mean field theory. A simple scaling law holds for a wide range of rotation rate. I would be surprised that this is not a good point in towards really a mean field model. We argue that this dichotomy is caused by the chemical composition of the two groups, where G1 is less metallic than G2. The sun is in G2 and it's not in any in transition of anything. starts in G1 have a standard, can be explained at least with a standard alpha omega dynamo action, while stars in G2 might have a meridional articulation drive driven dynamo action. Interesting, gyro chronology fails for stars in G2, but works very well with stars in G1. So it's possible that one of the spin-off of this result, if it will be confirmed, is that we will need two different gyro chronology calibration, depending whether stars are more metallic or less metallic. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks so much, Alfio, for a very interesting presentation. I ask you with your audience for questions. In the meantime, this exponent nu that you find to be either around minus 0.1 or plus 0.1 is the same exponent that in the old Noyes et al. Paper was actually found to be plus 1.25, right? It is really the same definition, or is that
subtlety? I think it's the same definition.
Yes,
I think he used the period, but it should be the, but if I'm so that might be, yeah. But it should be the same.
So it's very different, of course, and that is maybe one question. Another question is this G1 branch is actually a completely different one than anything that has been previously reported, because it is above the inactive branch. I mean, if anything can be related to an inactive branch, it look, as I said, it's already very different. But yours is above the sun. This G1 is above the sun, so it's an even shorter branch, isn't that right?
The sun is in G2.
Yeah, but the G1 branch is an even shorter cycle branch, which is very different from any previously reported branches, I think.
No, I don't think it's very different. The point is that if you look how the old classification, active versus non-active, is distributed in these two branches, you see that they are basically equally distributed between these two branches. So it's difficult to make a comparison with the
old active branch has very long periods. Different from what you're calling G1. So it's not.
Yeah, but the active branch, if you look at the other the results by Borocycle, they say they could not find any real correlation.
Yes, so, I understand. But so, your G1 is a different branch, that's what I'm saying. It's not anything like previous ones. It's one that actually lies on the other side of the solar branch.
Yes, because actually those are branches in the log-log plane, while most of the people have studied branches in this P-cycle P-rod.
Okay. There's a question by Simon. Simon Candelorisi, please.
Yeah, well, thanks for the talk. It was very good to see your observations.
Great to see you. Thank you very much. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So it's always good to see observations and we're together with the simulations. I was wondering about some of the data that you're using. You said that some of your findings are not statistically significant, but could you use maybe a much bigger data set, from data from Kepler, for instance, which has, observed like 120,000 stars, and there are probably enough stars that are relevant for you, sort of convective stars, and well, would that significantly improve your statistics?
No, I don't think so, because there is no cycle period measurements available. We need cycle period measurements. And here, the best we could do is to use what other people have done, namely improve the measurements of Mount Wilson data and include the measurement cycles from ARPS data, high resolution spectroscopy. But for Kepler, we don't have, unfortunately, there are few stars where there is a possible period, but not many. The question that we wanted to have a consistent data set. So we basically insist in using a cross-peric activity detected cycles. So we, for instance, we did not include fast rotating stars with the photometric cycles, because those are basically stars that are very young. We really wanted to focus on main sequence, cool stars with cycles which are detected out of chromospheric activity.
The best we have at the moment is Mount Wilson data when it comes to cycling.
But ARPS, we have the, if you look at this paper by Borosaico, there was already 10, 15 years of very well the high resolution spectroscopy. They were able to get some quite a good, let's say, data on cycles. So.
Thank you. Simon, next question by Gunther, please.
Hello, Albio. Nice to
hear you. Hello, Gunther. Nice to see you.
Nice to hear you.
Nice to hear you.
I have a short remark. As I understand, the meridional circulation-driven dynamo only works if the eddy diffusivity is very low, 10 to 11 or 5 to 10 to 11 centimeters per second.
That's true.
That means the magnetic Prandtl number must be high for such stars.
That's right.
This is not true for the alpha omega dynamo. So you are right, and there are two different branches in the main sequence stars, then one branch should have a high magnetic Prandtl number, and the other one a low magnetic Prandtl number. That's a big difference. I cannot imagine that the metallicity can define this difference, is it?
I think I agree with you, but you remember what we noticed, that because of the metallicity, the luminosity in G1 is higher than the luminosity than in G2.
Uh-huh.
So if you believed already to mixing length theory, that means that the eddy diffusivity in G2 will be smaller.
Uh-huh.
And that will immediately give you a magnetic Reynolds number, which is higher for G2 than for G1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I ask myself this question. And when I look at the average luminosity for G2 and for G1, I thought that was perfectly consistent with that.
So your argumentation is that metallicity makes a big difference in the status of the turbulence.
In the convective velocities.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That's nice because statement. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Gunther. Are there more questions? If do I understand correctly that the different stars all have this enter with the same weight? You don't have different weights for the many different stars.
What do we mean weights?
The weights of the certainty of the cycle period measurement, for example. If you have a star with a very low certainty, how would that enter in your statistics?
No, I mean we were very careful in using a weighted mean of the period. I'm not sure I understand your question.
So you mean a star which has a less certain period enters with a low weight? Is that what you're saying?
Oh yes, basically yes. Of course, we use a weighted
one. Yeah.
And we use the quasi-periodic determination. Quasi-periodic calculation of determination of the periods from Olspert and his group. Yes, we did that.
Okay, thanks. Gustavo, please, next question.
Gustavo.
Hi, Gustavo.
Thank you for your talk. It was very nice. I have a question kind of similar to Gunther's one, because you mentioned that for computed
I cannot understand.
No, he dropped. Poor connection.
When you presented... Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. When you present... It's better now?
Yeah, it's okay. Try again.
When you presented nu as a function of the size of the eddy, you mm-hmm. consider eta 10 to the 14.
Yes, yes.
Is that so?
Yes, but that is for G1.
It's only for G1. Okay. And also, if you go to the previous page, mm-hmm. for the interpretation of G2, so you say no. You say that the convective velocity depends on rotation, right?
That is angular momentum conservation along the azimuthal direction. That is a very
But normally, if you increase the rotation, the convective velocity decreases.
It depends. If you look at the bulk of the convective zone, it must be satisfied, that one. At the bottom,
why?
Probably right. But it's angular momentum conservation, Gustavo. There's no way you can avoid that. Just look at the Reynolds stress along the phi direction. Just global angular momentum conservation.
So if rotation tends to zero, then the convective velocities will be larger than if rotation is
in the, in the bulk, let's say, the average in the bulk of the convection zone. Of course. Okay.
I agree with this. Okay.
Well, but we can discuss that. It's an argument from Matthias Remper. We can discuss that together.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Thanks very much, Gustavo. Next question by Ia. Ia, please.
Hi, everybody. Very nice talk. I have a couple of questions. So from your final slide, I get that the metallicity has a lot to do with the dynamotype. I am correct in this?
Yes, you are correct.
So is there a general law or anything, or is there something that you see?
No, it's something that it is a way we interpret our result, because the only difference we saw in which is statistically significant between group one and group two is metallicity. And I believe, yes, please.
So what do you define high and low resolution for the spectra, that you are using?
Well, the Gaia is low resolution. I don't know, it's about how many thousand in lambda over delta lambda. High resolution is the spectra taken usually with ARPS. So it's depending, it's about the 30,000, something like that, as a resolution of the spectrograph, or even more. So we were very careful in combining this two spectra, taking into account of an offset that is it's present between Gaia, DR3, low resolution spectra, and high resolution spectra. So at the end, everything was done properly, I believe.
But from what I understood from your talk, there are stars where you are lacking the metallicity, right?
Stars where? There.
Where you don't have the metallicity number.
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, the number of stars is much, much more reduced in this case, because we want to have, if we only use a star, the Gaia low resolution metallicity, I think you have about 40 stars. And there, the trend is still there, but the p-value is smaller. So, the referee asked correctly, well, you have to be careful with the low resolution Gaia spectra for bright stars. And so it will be important to have a check with high resolution spectra. So what we did, we used first only high resolution spectra, and the result was the same. Only if you only look at high resolution spectra for and do a cross correlation with the catalog like Pastel, for instance, you will see that that's the trend is the same. So we wanted to really to be consistent. We selected the newest three catalogs where the high resolution spectra was done with the same technique and for which we could have measurements in Gaia spectra, and we combined that. So at the end, the number of stars was reduced, but the accuracy was really much better. And in that case, it is absolutely clear that the p-value was really much smaller, almost to 3 sigma detection.
Because I am starting a program here to follow up Monk-Wilson data, for Monk-Wilson star. And if you send me the stars, I can do the, I can observe them with a resolution of 60,000. Which I think will improve your statistics.
That would be absolutely great. Yes, yes. The stars are.
So, yeah.
Yes, I can. We can definitely send you the list of our catalog and make a comparison with the all. I think that is it's really essential to have a measurements of metallicity done in a uniform way.
I have the possibility of starting a long-term monitoring here. I'm working at the observatory, and I think having the metallicity for those stars will increase really a lot your statistical sample.
That would be great. If you send me an email, I will
get
back to you as soon as possible with me and Rigo discussing that. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Regarding the data, I see that you're referring to this website Diamonds, but is that actually including the actual data, or where do you actually have the data that you used?
Maybe Enrico, if he's going to he could answer this question.
Enrico?
Yes. You can clarify what you mean exactly by extra data?
The table. If I wanted to see, for example, the cycle period for.
Yeah, the table is online, is on CDS.
Yes, maybe you can even show us. You could share the screen. I see you have a link in your paper to the GitHub, but that is not what, or is that what you meant?
No, the link on GitHub is about the code.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, but can you maybe, you could just share us. That would be maybe the best, if that's okay without you.
Yeah, I can share the table if you want. Give me a minute, please.
Could you start sharing then, Alfio?
Yes, sure.
I have to find it first, so let me have the time. Maybe you can proceed with one more question.
Of course. Yeah, Günther has another question, please.
No, a suggestion maybe. If it is true that the two branches of Alfio's, in Alfio's talk, have different diffusivities, then it should be possible to test it, for example, by the decay of star spots or the decay of calcium emission also. I assume the difference between the etas must be one order of magnitude in order to be important, and that should be observable. Is it possible to observe star spots from your stars, Alfio?
Maybe, yes, that's a very good suggestion. I don't know. I am a little bit afraid that you have star spots. Well, you know, it's with CDI, maybe I have to think about that because there are certainly constraints, but in principle, it's a very good idea. I did not think about this possibility. But I agree with you that if this is true, then the properties of the eddy diffusivity in G1 and G2 must be different. And that somehow has to be possible, has to be, let's say, has to show off in some observation. Yes, that's true.
What else depends on the iterative diffusivity, the additive diffusivity, calcium emission? I don't know at the moment. But there should be also another possibility to test it, if really the eta strongly differ. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Now Enrico is trying to share the screen. It's not starting up yet.
It says that the screen sharing is paused. Let me assume.
There's a what?
He's trying to start.
Mm-hmm. No. Should we ask Frank for the next question in the meantime?
Okay. Thank you very much for the great talk. I have a very naive question. So I got the impression that the dynamo is a sort of function of the metallicity, whether you have alpha, omega, or meridional. Could it be the other way around, that the metallicity is a function of the basic dynamo, whether you have meridional circulation or not? Could it be that way also? It's a very naive question, I know.
No, the metallicity comes from the star formation.
I think that Gunther is correct. I don't think that can change that.
But we know, of course, the lithium problem and the role of Taylor instability and Amri and all that, which is a little bit connected with the dynamo. Could it be something else here in this case? Maybe not.
It's difficult to imagine that that something of that is produced by the, maybe some extra mixing, but extra mixing, what will do?
I think if there is turbulence, if there is convection in the convection zone, then it is mixed anyway.
I think so, yes.
Okay.
It's homogeneous in the elements.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Frank. So Enrico has
screen. I've sent the data to Alfio. Maybe Alfio can try. Probably I don't have the permission to do that. I don't know why.
No, everybody has permission here.
It says that
because it was also starting, almost starting up. Just didn't.
Yeah. And it says that the sharing is stopped for some reason, so I don't know.
Yes.
Maybe Alfio can try.
Okay. Alfio? We'll just wait just a moment. Okay. Let me just share it.
Okay. Yes.
Good.
Okay, so the address of that, how's that? That is public or is it not?
It should be public. Yeah.
I can send it to him with email.
Mm-hmm.
If you want.
Okay. Yes, very good. And for example, the star alpha horology is of course one with a very short cycle period. Where, in which branch does that show up? Iota horology.
Iota horology, yes. Mm. I think, no, we did not include the iota horology, of course, this thing. Because iota horology, you see, it is like in the sun, we have a very small cycle, no? This 11 cycle, this biennial cycle. And I think that iota horology has also two cycles. One, what we see is this small one. So that's the question is that that's most probably related with some turbulence scale, which is much smaller. While from my understanding of the dynamo that we have in the sun or in other stars, the typical turbulence scale that needed is really at the bottom of the convection zone. So that we decided really not to, to include the stars with where for instance that will show that the cycle, which could be like this double cycle in the sun. That's really, it was been a mistake from our point of view.
Yes, I think that is. I thought the iota horology is because of the rapid rotation in that case.
Yeah, that's true. But I think that's happening. That is, if you look at the Rossby number, it's not very different from the sun, because it's a FS class, spectral class is a little bit different from the sun. And so I think that's, I would expect that cycle period is.
Okay. Well, and what about, for example, Alpha Centauri, which is a very old one, and Metcalf was thinking it's on the transition to stopping to cycle.
Well, I'm not sure if we have a reliable period on where Alpha Centauri. It doesn't belong to the Mount Wilson set.
No, but it's southern hemisphere, of course. But there is a very clear X-ray cycle, of course.
Yeah, that's what we know. But it's to assess.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much, Alpio. I don't see any other questions at this moment, unless anybody wants to continue chatting here. I then stop the recording.